Honourable members, also welcome to the Executive Director of IPATELI's delegation, as well as the Acting Head of the Civilian Secretariat and his delegation. Also welcome to civil society and the media. Honourable members, we will continue today with our public hearings in terms of preparations for budget vote. Members, just a few administrative matters. We have made available today a copy of the A-list bill in terms of the critical protection, critical infrastructure protection bill. So we just want to ask members to go through it that we on Wednesday can adopt and then move to the next phase in terms of our deliberations. So we made copies available to members and so that we will try also then to adopt that. Then, linked to that, members, we're going to reorganize the program a bit in terms of May, the first 2 weeks, to focus mainly on the critical infrastructure bill. There's just two additional meetings that we will change to the Fridays. The one is the quarterly report of SAPS and the quarterly report of IPAT. So that will move to the Fridays, but we'll forward that program to members. But because legislation is priority, we will utilize this first and the second week of May to deal with the critical infrastructure protection bill. So members, I just want to put that on the table. Then I will give an opportunity for the members to introduce themselves.
Goeiemôre, dames en heren. My name is Angie Mulewati. Ek is die lid van hierdie komitee en ek dank u.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Igamuza Kelembele, member of the committee.
Diane Kohler-Barnard, also member of the committee. Before we move on, Chair, which two Fridays would those be? Do you have the dates?
Make it available early next week, but that will be the two Fridays following that 2 weeks. Also welcome to Honourable Nabatakane. Then we'll ask the Executive Director, Mr. McBride, to introduce his delegation.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. On my right hand side is Antoinette Mbako, who basically is the engine of the organization in the Executive Director's Office. On my left is National Head of Investigations, Mr. Matthew Sissoko. On his left is our Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Victor Senna. And on his left is Ms. Marianne Morwaswi, the Head of Legal. And on her left is the Susan De Klappe, the Acting Director, Strategy and Performance Monitoring. And on her left is Ma'am Nomkosi Nitsianda, the Head of Corporate Services. And on her left is Mr. Moses Lamini, National Spokesperson. And somewhere in the house is Dr. Chris Mokobetiti. But he'll be coming in now as our Parliamentary Liaison Officer.
Thank you very much, Executive Director. Let's go straight to the presentation and over to the Executive Director and his team. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Just some preliminary remarks before. In May last year, in April last year, when we went through the same process, we had given a substantive argument for alleviating the budget pressures, indicating what the needs are and where we are facing pressures. That has still not changed. There's been some alleviation, but not sufficient. There's also the period where we began to, as a result of the budgetary constraints, to change focus and to make a strategic decision to go into high-value low volumes investigations, high impact investigations, and mainly systemic corruption within the police. What we know now, as opposed to what we knew then, is a completely different animal, and the enormity of it is much worse than we had anticipated in the beginning in May. So the corruption is extensive, it's deep-seated, and it runs as a system. The system of corruption within SAPS, where majority of procurement is mainly a vehicle, a conduit, for money changing hands illegally. However, it's important to mention that even though for a period of 18 months, IPED was the lone beacon of hope in the fight against corruption, before it became fashionable, as it has done recently, we can say that perhaps the most important fruit of our hard work and commitment is the fact that the environment, the anti-corruption environment that is now present, makes life a bit more easier for us, and I would imagine that the appetite to tackle corruption head-on is there. So even though we still have these budgetary constraints, we have other pressures on us, we still get in death threats and other attempts to derail the investigations, we feel optimistic in the sense that the climate is changing for the better, which will enable us to carry on our fight effectively. Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, we will start with the CFO dealing with the budgetary matters, and then we will go to Mem Letlape on strategy and performance, and then it will be the programs from 1 up to 3. And I'll hand over to the CFO now, sir. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, E.D., and good morning, Chairperson and Honourable Members. I think before I start, Chairperson, I think for us as IPED, it's very much important that we should continuously emphasize the fact that we are underfunded as IPED, and this results in us not being able to fully implement our mandate as a department. So it's quite important that we keep on flagging this issue, because it greatly impacts on our ability to be fully independent as a department. Just as an introduction, corruption in South Africa, Chairperson, it's on an annual basis we lose in excess of 27 billion due to corruption, and as a result, it results in job losses. Just last year, the estimated number of jobs that were lost as a result of corruption, it was around 76,000. And also, if you look at the annual report of SAPS, they have indicated that, you know, the claims against the department, as at last year, it was around 5.1 billion. So if you look at the two first points, it indicates the importance that IPED is playing. So which is why I'm saying that it's quite important that, you know, as a department, we are fully funded, because we play a very pivotal role in terms of the two points that I've raised before. The first one being that IPED is at the forefront of making sure that the war against corruption is intensified. And also, if you look at the issues that SAPS has been sued for, it falls within the mandate of IPED. So for me, Chairperson, the point that I want to emphasize is that if we are fully funded as IPED, it will make our job very much easier in terms of saving the state money. And then the fourth point there, I'm trying to emphasize that as a department, we've implemented measures internally, you know, to deal with the challenges that we are facing. The first one is that we are continuously identifying those areas where, you know, there might be areas of wastage And then that money is then reprioritized towards the mandate of IPED. And then the second one, I think all of us were aware that last year we were qualified, and we've implemented measures to make sure that we assess the qualification. And we are quite confident that this financial year, the qualification will be addressed. And then the third measure that we're implementing as chairperson is to make sure that we continuously lobby for additional funding. We are continuously engaging with Treasury and also with SAPS to make sure that we can get some of additional resources to help us in this fight against corruption. And then on the second slide, Chairperson, what I'm trying to emphasize there is that we've got risks as a department that are impacting on the little budget that we have. The first one I think Edie has already highlighted on it is that we are underfunded as a department. If you look at the budget growth, it's not in line with the inflation rate. And also our contractual obligations are not fully funded. So this places a very pressure on our budget because we have to take money from goods and services and try to fill the gap. And then the other challenge that we are facing, Chairperson, is that our compensation of employee is crowding out spending on goods and services. So there what I mean is that currently compensation of employees is around 67%. So it means we've got a little money left for us to be able to procure the items that are critical to the investigation. The third point, Chairperson, there has been an increase in the value of accruals over the past 3 years. If you look at the 2014-15, you'll notice that our accruals were at the region of 5.3 million, but they've risen to 24.3 million in the 2016-17 financial year. And this can be attributed directly to the fact that we are underfunded as the department. And then the fourth one that I'm trying to emphasize there, Chairperson, is that we've had an increase in the litigation cases because, as ED has already mentioned, is that SAPS, for example, they will do the counter-investigation and then we are forced to defend ourselves. So that money comes from the goods and services budget. And then on the next slide, Chairperson, what I'm trying to demonstrate there is to show that if you take our budget and you minus the salaries that we are paying and you minus the accruals and also the contractual obligation, it means in reality we only have 6 million for us to be able to operate. So I'm just trying to demonstrate the challenge that we are facing internally, that once you take all our obligation into account, it means you don't have enough funds to operate. We followed four principles when we decided on how to allocate the budget this financial year. The first one being that we decided that as IPED we are going to focus on the high impact cases, but this doesn't mean that we are going to neglect those Gogota Minutes cases. So the logic here, Chairperson, is that if you focus on the high impact cases, the consequence of that is that we are hoping to deter, you know, the lower cases from happening. And then the first one is to finalize the review of the IPED Act. We've actually allocated 1.2 million to that. And then the third one is that we want to safeguard the information. I think you are aware that it's quite critical for us as IPED to make sure that the information that we are dealing with is safeguarded. So it's one of the priorities that we are going to focus on. And then the fourth one is to make sure that we conduct community outreach events. I think here the focus is to make sure that, you know, we improve the visibility of IPED. I think if you can look at social media, Chairperson, you'll see that most people, when they are in the situation where they've experienced, you know, abuse or misconduct on the part of staff, they don't know where to go. So it tells me that, you know, we need to go out there to tell people that, you know, as IPED, this is the service that we are offering. And then on the next slide, what we are trying to emphasize there is that it's quite important that IPT is fully funded. I think for us, funding IPT is an investment. I think the first point we are trying to show that already we've prevented a loss of $45 million to the fiscals. And also the case that we are currently involved in, there is a further $5 billion that we can save to the state. So this is the value add that we are offering as IPT. It goes back to my introduction to say, if you fully fund IPT, in a way it's an investment because in the long term we are going to be able to save money for the state. And then the other issues that I'm emphasizing there is also that, you know, by making sure that IPT is fully funded, it will lead to reduced levels of corruption. It will make sure that you are fully able to investigate the cases that are referred to us. And also we'll be able to have that in-house expert for us to be able to perform the investigation. And also we'll have money for the litigation cases that I've already alluded to. And also it will make sure that IPT is fully accessible to the ordinary people, as I've already mentioned. And then on the next slide, I'm just showing the allocation, Chairperson. The first one is just the history in terms of the allocation for IPET. So if you look at the 2013-14, our budget, overall budget was sitting at $217 million. And then moving forward to 2017-18, it was around $255.5 million. And this year it's sitting at $315.1 million, mainly because of the funding that we received from SAPS. So if you look at the growth between 17-18 and 18-19, you'll see that it's around 14%. Again, it's mainly due to the funding that we received from SAPS. The next slide is just to explain, like I've already explained in the previous slide. I think we can move to the next slide. So in this slide, again, we are trying to demonstrate the budget growth of the over the MTEF. If you look at the 2017-18 to 2018-19, our budget is increasing by $59.6 million. And then 1920 is going to increase by $21.6 million. And then on the 2019-20 is going to increase to by $22.7 million, which in percentage terms is around 6.7%. And then the next slide is just to demonstrate the allocation in terms of economic classification. If you look at the 2018-19, the compensation of employees is currently allocated $202.2 million, which represents 67.3% of the budget. And then goods and services, it's allocated $97.7 million, and then it represents 31.1% of the budget. You can move to the next slide. This is just to demonstrate the allocation per program. You'll notice there that program one is allocated $109 million, which represents 35% of the total allocation. And our core business, which is program two, we've allocated $190 million, which represents 60% of our budget. And then the last program, which is program three, we've allocated $16 million, which represents 5% of the total total budget. And then the next slide, if you look at the first table there, I'm demonstrating the allocation for program one, which is the administration. Compensation is allocated $64.2 million for program one, which is 59% of the budget. And then your goods and services is 39.6, which is 36.3% of the budget. And then program two, you will see that the compensation of employees is allocated $134 million, which represents 71% of the allocation. That is mainly because all our investigators are located within Program 2. And then your goods and services is $56 million, which represents 29% of the allocation for Program 2. Overall, Program 2 is allocated $190 million. And then our last program, which is program three, compensation of employees, it's 13.9 million, which represent 87% of the allocation for this program. And then when you look at your goods and services, it's allocated 2 million, which is 13% of the allocation. And then overall, if you look at the 2018-19 for Program 3, we've allocated just over 16 million for this program. The next slide just demonstrates the allocation for compensation of employees. If you look at the 2018-19, we started the year with 388 warm bodies. So based on the allocation that we received from SAFS, we are going to add additional 27 employees to our structure, mainly to strengthen internal controls and also to address non-compliance issues. So the personnel that we are going to employ there, they'll be located in terms of making sure that we strengthen our internal control and also to address the audit issues, mainly around our internal audit, our supply chain, and all the other support programs. So this will take then our total headcount to 419 this financial year. On the next slide, we are just trying to show what remains unfunded for IPET. I think the key one is to make sure that we fully implement the IPET strategy, where we wanted to also establish some of the district offices. So this one, it still remains a challenge for us because due to financial pressures, we are actually forced to close some of the satellite offices, again making the issue of access and visibility even worse for the department. And then the next one is to implement the Phylum Commission report, which indicates that as IPET, we need to have external experts in the department. So because of the funding issues, again, we are not able to make sure that we've got those experts that assist us at the department. And then again, we are not able to fully implement Section 23 of the IPET Act because of the funding issues. The other activity that is unfunded is our disaster recovery plan for the department. And then the last one is the implementation of the security analysis report, which requires that security measures at both head office and the provinces need to be strengthened. So because we don't have enough funding, we are not able to fully implement these activities that I've listed in this slide. And that is the presentation on the finances, Chairperson.
Thank you, Sipho, Executive Director.
Chairperson, ma'am, the clerk will take over.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. And good morning to the honorable members. I will be taking you through slide 19. The purpose for this slide is to reflect the changes on our strategic plan and also the annual performance plan. With regard to the strategic plan, which covers the period 2015 to 2020, there were no changes to our strategic objectives and also on our strategic indicators and the five-year strategic targets. And the other issue that we also want to flag out with regard to our strategic plan is that the targets for the 2020-21 financial year, they are not contributing to the five-year strategic targets. And we just wanted to make sure that the honorable members, they are not confused when you check the annual targets and when you compare them with the five-year strategic targets, they might be you might see that there is a disjuncture if you want to add also the 2021 annual target. But this is also covered in our APP. We have inserted a footnote just to make sure that there is no confusion, because the MTSF target is up to 1920 financial year. And in our APP, the significant changes in our 18-19 APP, the first one is the issue of the budget program structure. We know that in the previous financial years, we were having four budget program structures, but that was reviewed in the 17-18. From 17-18, they were reduced to 3, and with legal services being not a budget program structure. And there have been several engagements with the National Treasury, and the agreement was that legal services will be considered as to be a budget one of the budget program structures in the year 1920, but there were also conditions that National Treasury has put forth on their response. So what is expected from us is to review the indicators for the legal services and also to ensure that we cover the concerns that National Treasury has had raised with regard to their indicators. So as it is now, our APP is aligned to the budget program structure as reflected in our ENE. And what we did with our legal services indicators, they were spread between Program 1 and Program 2 in terms of the relevancy of the indicators to the two budget program structures. And the other significant issue on the adjustment of our program performance indicators for Program 1, there were two indicators that were taken out of the APP. That is the number of risk reports, and the other one, it was on the number of statistical reports. This was as a recommendation from the National Treasury and the DPME, because what happens is that we submit our draft APPs to those two departments, and they provide analysis reports, and it was recommended that we take them out because they were too operational. But they were replaced by two indicators. The first one, it measures the implementation of risk mitigation strategies, and the other one is on the evaluation, implementation of the evaluation plan. And for Program 2, the significant changes is in relation to the indicators on investigation. We have changed the calculation type from percentage to numbers, and the reasons thereof is that we have considered the implication of the denominator, which is inconsistent, which is informed by the number of intake cases that we register in a particular financial year. Because of the inconsistency of the intake, it affects our performance output, because in time when we set our targets, what informs our target setting will be the intake of the previous financial year. And we have observed that we have been experiencing an increase in our intake, and that affects our output when we report for our performance. So that was the major contributing factor on the changes of the calculation type. For Program 3, the changes on our indicator, we have merged the stakeholder engagement indicator for the national and provincial engagements. And the other change is that we have added 4 new indicators under Program 3. And the intention of having those 4 new indicators, we want to analyze the recommendations that we produce as the department to ensure that there is quality in our recommendations. And also the other aspect of the analysis is to analyze the outcomes that we receive from SAPS and also from the NPA. Particularly on the SAPS one, we just want to ensure that there is consistency in terms of outcomes on the implementation of our recommendations. In brief, that is all on the changes.
Thank you very much. Executive Director.
Honorable Chairperson, Mamnitz.
Th-
Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members. Program one, the purpose of the program is to provide strategic leadership, management, and support services to the department. The program is structured into 6 components and 12 units, namely departmental management. We've got executive support, which is an engine of the organization, as the ED has alluded to. They ensure that the Office of the Executive Director is effective and efficient by providing the support that is necessary for that particular office. We've got corporate governance. They are ensuring that IPED is complying with good governance principles. They provide corporate risk management as well as ethics management for the IPED by identifying risk areas that IPED need to address in order for IPED to comply with good governance principles. We've got a strategy and performance management. They are responsible to develop our strategic plans, annual performance plans, as well as reporting and performance management, performance monitoring and evaluation. We've got security management, which is responsible for both physical security in line with physical information.
Is your thinking directly? Maybe we can go straight to the targets. Remember the structure of the department. The members are fine with that. If we maybe just go straight to the targets, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
All right. The strategic objectives of the program one: a capable workforce. Indicator number of strategic training areas undertaken as per IP's training plan. Strategic target is 21, 7 for 2018-19, 7 for 2019-20, and 7 for 2020-21 financial years. The following table present program performance indicators and MTF annual targets that will be implemented. A vacancy rate, we're planning to keep it below 10% throughout MTEF period. Percentage of annual internal audit plan, we are planning to implement 80% throughout MTEF period. This is in line with allocated budget and available capacity within internal audit unit. Implementation of risk mitigation strategies, the risks that have been identified, we are unable to implement 100%, so we will implement 40% during 18-19 financial year, 50% during 19-20 financial year, and 60% during 2021, in line with available budget that has been allocated for IPED. Number of evaluations conducted per year, we will ensure that at least this financial year we've got a plan that is approved, so that come 2019-20 we will be able to implement that particular plan. The plan involves the development of the evaluation framework, which is in line with DPME guidelines, as well as consultation with management in terms of priorities that need to be addressed, and then later on the plan is approved. A percentage of written legal opinions provided to the department within 30 working days of the request. 70% will be provided within this particular time frame. This is in line with available capacity within the legal services. Percentage of contracts service level agreements finalized within 30 working days of the request. It's 70% as well throughout MTEF period, in line with available resources. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Chianda, Executive Director.
Now I have Mr. Sissoko.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable members, I'll take you through the targets for Program 2. Safe to indicate that, taking the cue from the Chairperson, that the purpose is known to the committee as well as the sub-program. I just indicate that the sub-program for investigation advisory, as we've indicated, that this is a sub-program that comes originally from legal services, which is no longer part of the programs. The next slide deals with the strategic objectives on specialized investigative capacity established. Our indicator there is the number of investigators trained on specialized services as per investigation training plan. And the target is 325 over the medium term, and it's 75, 2018-19, and up to 2020-2021. Decision-ready cases, the target is 60, and then we've targeted 45% for 18-19, and it goes to 47, 2019-20, and we continue with 47 to 2020-21. And then on providing investigation advisory services to investigators, the indicator there is percentage of legal advice provided to investigators from the total requests received, and we put our targets there at 90%. And then with regard to performance indicators, as Ms. Letlape indicated, we moved from percentages to numbers, as we had indicated also in our previous engagements with the committee, that in our next strategic plans, we're going to look at our targets to ensure that they are aligned to the actual baselines, but also to the actual resources and capacity that we have as a department. And as a part of that process, we also identify the need, therefore, to move from percentages to numbers. So with regard to our first program performance indicator of percentage of cases registered and allocated within 72 hours of written notification, we retain the percentages there, and 79% for 2018-19, 80% for 19-20, and we continue with 80% for 2020-21. And the number of statistical reports on investigation generated, we have done two reports. This would be your half-yearly report as well as our annual report. This is based also on an engagement with the Auditor General with regard to this target, and which they also recommended. On the number of investigation of death in police custody that are decision ready, as we've indicated, we've now changed from percentages to numbers, and we made a target there of 150 throughout the MTEC period. And then the number of investigation of death as a result of police action, we have 130 cases over MTEC. The number of investigation of discharge of official firearm by police officer that are decision ready, we have 500 over the MTEC period. Number of investigation of rape by a police officer that are decision ready was 65 over MTEC period. Number of investigation of rape while in police custody that are decision ready, we've got 10 over MTEC period. Number of investigation of torture that are decision ready, we've got 60 over MTEC period. Number of investigation of assault that are decision ready, we've got 2,000 over the period. Number of investigation of corruption that are decision ready, we've got 60 for 18-19, and it goes to 66 for 19-20, and continue 66 for 2020 to 2021. Number of investigation of other criminal and misconduct matters referred to in terms of section 28(1)(h) and 33, it's 80 over the period. the number of approved systemic corruption that are decision ready or retained to, the number of all backlog decision ready cases. We've got 1,250 over the period. The number of dockets referred to the National Prosecuting Authority within 30 days of being signed off, we retained 90% over the period. Number of disciplinary recommendation reports referred to Sarawakian Police Service and Municipal Police within 30 days of sign-off, we also retained 90% over the period. On the next slide, these are the indicators linked to the erstwhile legal services program. Percentage of oral legal advice provided to investigators within 24 hours is 90% over the period. Percentage of written legal advice provided to investigators within 2 working days of request, 90% within the period, and percentage of per year requests finalized within 30 days is 100%. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Sissoko, Executive Director.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Ma'am Morwasi will give input. My apologies, Mr. Dlamini.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. If you look at slide 32, our strategic objective is to ensure an integrated communication and stakeholder engagement strategy. And the indicator is the percentage implementation of that strategy. For 2018-19, we have set a target of 90%. If you look at the previous APP, you'll see there that we were talking about or we had targeted 25% of action plans, but we realized that because of the budget constraints that we're facing, we have to amend our action plans on an annual basis, and therefore we thought that setting the target in the way that we've done would allow us to then change based on the circumstances in planning for the future implementation of the strategy. The indicators for the community outreach events. In slide 33, the number of community outreach events conducted 2018-19 up to 2021, we've targeted 80 events per year. This has come down from 108 due to budgetary constraints. Then the number of formal engagements held with key stakeholders, we have matched provincial and national, and we have now a consolidated number of 128 throughout. And then you have also the number of disciplinary recommendations referred to SAPS and MPS that are analyzed. It's 1,000 recommendations, and that is throughout the MTF period. Then the number of criminal referrals forwarded to NPA that are analyzed. Our target there is 748 throughout the MTF. And then the percentage of responses from SAPS and MPS that are analyzed is 50% throughout. And lastly, the percentage of responses from the NPA that are analyzed, again, the target is 50%. That is it from my side, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dlamini, Executive Director.
Thanks, Honourable Chairperson.
Morning. Thank you, Idi. Morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. I will be speaking to the budget of the IPID vis-a-vis litigation that we are involved with currently as a department. You will realize, Honourable Members, as Idi has pointed out that since 2014-15, the IPID has been on the forefront of the fight against corruption. ED mentioned that before it was fashionable to be fighting corruption, the IPID was already fighting corruption. Now, because of the strides that were made by the IPID in this instance, this resulted in the incapacitation of the effort
to incapacitate the IPID, and this resulted in what has now been known as the exile of the ED and some of the senior members of the IPID. Now, the Watershed McBride judgment ensured that the ED and also those senior management were given some reprieve, and so was the IPID, because this judgment reinforced the IP's operational and structural independence. And when the ED came back, he made an undertaking that he would then take on high-impact cases. Now, the genesis or where these emanate from is from the Pahlane judgment, where the then erstwhile acting National Commissioner of Police was being investigated for corruption and other related offences. Now, these high-profile cases or high-impact cases that were being investigated led to civil litigation that IPID is currently embroiled in, and also counter-investigations against IPID investigation members, including the ED of the IPID. Now, this civil litigation that we are currently involved with is very lengthy and very costly, because it involves members of senior members of SAPS and also political heads in this instance. And these senior members seem to have an unlimited budget for litigation and also an appetite for it. Now, at the present moment, if I can just update the committee, we are involved in a number of litigation that it involves the then acting National Commissioner of Police, and also a number of members that were reporting to him at the time that had been brought in to carry out counter investigations against the IPID. The matters have been set down for argument in June this year. So that litigation is proceeding. The litigation, as I've indicated, is not only, IPID in the past was not given a budget for litigation, but since 2016, if you can look at the expenditure that has been spent on litigation, it is in excess of 6 million. It's reflected in the presentation that in the 2016-17 financial year, we spent in excess of 1 million on litigation. In the 2017-18 financial year, we spent in excess of five million on litigation. The result of these vexatious and malicious civil suits is that they deplete that very minimal budget of the IPID. Now, because of the terrain that we are currently in, with the fact that we are busy unearthing a lot of corruption within the senior management of SAPS, it is clearly to be expected that this litigation is going to intensify. And at the present moment, IPID still does not have the budget for these future expected litigation. Hence our plea that we should be funded in order to enable us to be able to discharge our constitutionally a constitutional mandate. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much for the presentation. ED?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. In conclusion, with all the pressures on us, we still have to comply with the legislation and Treasury regulations and the PFMA, so in order that we don't overspend, that we stay within our budget, and we still manage to get as much of our mandate implemented, we'll do regular monitoring of expenditure, and this will be done by executive committee members, the budget control committee and EXCO. Continuous reprioritization of core activities. It's important that we are quite agile with our strategic reprioritizations and assessments. The continuous implementation of cost containment measures against strengthening internal controls. We are hoping that we'll get concurrence from the DPSA for the 27 additional posts that are involved in control and with the checks and balances. We require the support from the Ministry and PCP for the full successful implementation of the Concord and the entire amendment of the Act so that all sections can pass constitutional muster and are consistent with the initial Concord judgment. Full implementation of FALUM. FALUM Commission recommendations and pronouncements complement the Concord judgment to assist with securing additional funding. It has been a song, but we are reaching a crisis point by evidence of being forced to close satellite offices. So slowly our ability to fulfill our mandate has been eroded because of budgetary pressures, and that also affects our independence. So without adequate financial and human resources, IPUD will not be able to fulfill its mandate. And this has national interest implications beyond policy. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Executive Director and the team for the presentation. Members, we will go to questions. Again, just a call I made yesterday. Let's keep it focused, concise, to the point. First few from my side, and then I'll go to the Honorable Members. I think it's quite important that IPUD should get the necessary financial support. Now, the Minister of Finance, Minister Nene, he wrote back to the committee on the 23rd of March regarding our request regarding last year's budget hearings, where we requested more money, and he indicated there was additional allocations made to IPUD. And I think the members of the delegation indicated the allocations. But it's quite clear from the submission, and I maybe just want to get the ED on that. Corruption in the police is a huge, it's a huge problem, and it must be dealt with head on. We need the police that can be trusted, and if there's problems in the leadership or in high-ranking officials, it must be fully investigated. It's quite clear from your presentation that, in terms of systemic corruption and from the portfolio committee side, that should be the focus. You need at least an additional 20 million rand. Additional 20 million rand. If you want to really deal with it. So we'll also hear what other members say in the ED, but I think we must make that recommendation that there must be an additional 20 million rand made available, because it's quite clear, it's very difficult cases, it is complex, and if IPUD is not allowed to do it, must be dealt with. Then specifically with regard to FALUM, I just want to know, is there any specific allocation in terms of FALUM? Yesterday the police indicated that they got additional 353 in this financial year. I think you have 353 for buying equipment and so forth. Was there any budget item regarding FALUM, the recommendations that was made available to IPUD? And then just my last question, I see there's still 1.2 million in your budget for the IPUD Amendment Bill. Now, factually, it's the bill is with Parliament. Of course, there must be a major overhaul of the IPUD Act, especially if the SAPS Act is going to be amended in the next year or two. So I just want to know, couldn't that 1.2 million maybe used for other purposes if the McBride judgment will be dealt with by Parliament? But it's quite clear long term, looking at the environment, the IPUD Act will have to be overhauled, but it will be strategic, I think, in my view, that to see what the SAPS Act will look like, and then maybe come with a review process. Honorable Mula.
Thank you, Chakasin, and thank you for your presentation. In slide 12, compensation of employees. Its budget is too high. Why can't you take the money to the other votes? Because you can't budget 60% for the compensation of employees. My second question, you keep on saying you don't have enough money, and now it's a new financial year. Why can't you budget for all your things enough money for you? Not saying, coming to us and saying, of course, who's doing your budget? It's you or is the other people who's doing your budget? My third question, can you please elaborate on the status of the National Specialized Investigation Team and how the performance of this team is measured. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Mula, Honourable Mabija, Honourable Mark.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just two questions. The transfers, if I could be, if it could be explained, or what does it entail? Where do you transfer to? The second question would be, I'm trying to crack my head. The movement from percentages to actual numbers. I fail to understand how you could put your target in terms of numbers. If, let me just take an example, number of investigations that as a result of police action that are decision ready. I'm trying to think, or is there any way you could predict or how many people are going to die in police custody? And if you can't do that, then how do you put numbers there? Unless if I don't understand very clearly. Because percentages would have been the right thing, because it will depend on how many died. But if you put 130, how do you know? How do you predict? Or police are going to kill how many? And there's some figures here that slide number 27. Strategic target. I thought the strategic target was distributed into this financial year. 18, 19, 20, and 2021. If that is the understanding, then the strategic target, I don't think it's, if it's an addition of the three, then it can't be 325, it must be 225. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Maki, Honorable Mulabachi, Honorable Ramatakone, I'll come back to you. You're welcome.
My first question is, what qualifies a case to be a high impact case? Is it the amount that is being investigated or the status of the person that is being investigated? My second one is, what is the status of the evaluation plan? My third one, in the matter of you vetting, are all your members vetted? My last one, if you send a case or cases to NPA, how long does it take to get feedback or responses if you do get any? Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Mulabachi, Honourable Ramatakane.
Thank you very much, Chair. The also just a few questions. On the administration side, the targets, remember the issue about internal audits, one of the problems is the capacity to be able to deal with all the internal, including the concerns of the AG. When you set the target to be 80%, would you think that it's sufficient in terms of dealing with that? To be able to deal with all the internal matters at the 80%. Just explain it, because one of the things that will trip you in terms of the compliance is going to be meeting all the, dealing with, clearing all the issues that are raised. While I'm on that issue, just to question whether the, what is the internal audit capacity, are they optimal? Are they functioning optimally in terms of functionality as prescribed, including the accessibility to areas that they need to investigate or evaluate during the period. Third question, Chair, is the accruals. If my memory serves me correctly, perhaps it's one of the things that led to qualified opinion. And the figure at the time was lesser. I think in a presentation you mentioned that it's growing, that particular issue. I'm interested to know about that accrual, the issue about disclosure of the accrual, whether that happened year on year, if we're actually dealing with it. And how do we control it? Because if it's going to continue to be a runaway train, then it's going to continue to be a problem. It's going to be an albatross that does not stop. Chair, while I'm on that issue and the budget allocation sufficient or insufficient, I think I do agree about this additional money that the Chair speaks about, that we should make such a recommendation. But, you know, just as an information, maybe it will be useful to help us to understand. Based on the IPED constitutional mandate and the functionality, to function optimally in terms of what they do, this is a question we asked other agencies some time back. In your budget cycle, budget presentation, I suspect you make recommendation or make submission. What has been the budget proposal, understanding your own mandate, that has been submitted in the cycle of MTF budget process? In order for us to be able, because we say 20 million, but what was the request? What was the submission in terms of the proposal that was done before? Or was it just dependent on the, well, of course we can see indicative amount year on year, but the indicative amount remains indicative until we get to it throughout the circle in terms of the circle of a budget. What has been the presentation from IPED on that aspect? The last one, Chair, for me is the PMFA prescribe what is called the employee compensation of employees or filling of vacancies. And now, if you were to shift resource from filling of vacancies because vacancies were not filled, then you are required in terms of treasury to, in fact, in terms of treasury and the PMFA, there's a prohibition on that. But if you do see last year, you have shifted some of the money. Has that been granted as a permission beforehand by Treasury? Is it going to be continuous to be the issue? And I know that you did talk about keeping your 10% vacancy rate. 10% vacancy rate, if that's I think it's a good thing. But has the staff establishment completely been adopted, finally stamped on, accepted in terms of what your staff establishment is going to be, or what is going to be, and what is budgeted on that budget, the staff establishment of the department? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Kane, Honourable Mshlongo.
Well, thank you, Chairperson. From the very beginning, I will say, Chairperson, my concern stands that if the country is over a 3 trillion rent in red, most of that being through corruption, it means some drastic steps are required, and all engines need to pull to that direction towards recovery of that money for the country to be able to stand on both feet. Not necessarily focusing on IPIT alone, but all organs of state are responding to that because of veracity of corruption. Now, having said that, I wonder if maybe IPIT would be able to shed light in terms of support it gets from other organs of state, particularly in dealing with these very complex criminal activities, which I think even SCOPA is actually currently seized with, stemming from police activities, particularly within the forensic department, as we have seen. And I think that tells it all, that these things that have been reported all along have never just been just a daydreaming exercise. They are there, as SCOPA is actually verifying it, and currently being seized with, and running into millions, if not billions, of rands that have just been lost into the sea out of these malpractices that is taking place. Now, is IPIT getting support from other specialized organs of state that are actually then responsible for investigation of such criminal? Are they cooperating with you in ensuring that they give support to these things? Because you alone, at times, you might not have capacity to actually then live up to standard. I'm just specifically, particularly, to be very straightforward, this matter of Pahlane seems to me to be very, very complex. If it runs to SADC countries, if it involves all these big fishes that are involved here, it means some serious, serious work needs to be done, even at specialized units like DPCI, forfeit procedure units, and all these things. If they are not mobilized, if they are not cooperating, it will be very, very unlikely for IP to succeed in these areas, Chairperson, particularly with the amount of money and also personnel that is at their disposal. That is why then I'm asking this question, because if and only if we can just leave it as a baby of IP, I think it will be grossly irresponsible, even of us. We will be just giving a blind eye to the glaring reality that has been there facing the country, which at the end of the day will cause serious security risk for the country moving forward. That was just a comment, but with that flagged question in it, which I think we definitely need to get some kind of direct response to that. Coming to page 17, with these non-funded activities of these sub-programs, does it mean that these sub-programs will be grounded for you, that they won't be actually be kept running? Because that could actually then also have its own negative consequences, because they are quite important things that need to be addressed there. Coming to page 23, when you talk of the number of strategic training areas, to building of state capacity, it means there must be incentives to staff. The type of training that is given to staff, is it an accredited training? Because if it is accredited, it actually then motivates people, because it also goes with incentives. And it also secures the future of the people. You know, people in life have got some expectations of upward movement, rather than just these trainings for attendance, certificates, and all these things, which don't necessarily upgrade the standard one of living, two of what I can call a professional upgrade of a person. Now, I think is it accredited training or non-accredited training? Because if it is non-accredited training, it might not necessarily lead us to the desired destination of building a sufficient capacity of state machine, of state organs, where people will actually then see the future of actually then spending their livelihood or their time serving the nation. So these are the very, very important key parts. Coming to page 32, because of limited resource at your disposal, I think in one of the presentations, I've forgotten, but in the stakeholder presentation hearings that we have held, it was very clear that particularly in some impoverished areas, some people get ill treatment from our South African Police Service. And they don't necessarily know what to do with those ill treatments they get, because they are not necessarily aware of your existence as a department that they can lay complaint with. So for this kind of information, which is part and parcel of this corporate image of yours and all that, do you envisage forming some partnership with some stakeholders that are involved? Because if not mistaken, I think that was the social justice organization. Yes, that was raising that particular issue, because they are mostly active in these areas. They were focusing particularly on areas like Khayelitsha, etc. But beyond Khayelitsha, I've seen it myself. Some people really, when they will run to you, they will decide to run to you as a member of parliament because they don't know that that matter should have been raised with IPED, because they don't know. Because you are only existing at provincial offices because of lack of financial resources. So then the last question of the recommendations, Chairperson, I definitely concur with you that though I don't know, as Honorable Ramatshakane has tempted me a bit, whether then if then you are suggesting at least roughly 20 million rand additional funding to IPED, whether it will also be able to meet the requirement. But I definitely concur with you that even only if we cannot actually put our money where our mouth is, instead we keep on dumping or doing this fiscal dumping to where we don't even know what will be the returns, as I've been raising with these things. That even with our police, this thing that we are told of, so many billions of rands go to IT every year, but you don't get told as to whether, when are they going to leave the level or come to the level of optimization of their own IT capabilities every year since 1994 up until now. You don't know what's happening there. Now, then that actually then makes me to be very suspicious of this fiscal dumping, that serious fiscal dumping, instead of putting money to where our mouth is, whereby we are going to be able to take the country forward. So thank you very much,
Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. First question is just a quick one for an information point. On page 14 of the published APP, it makes the statements that although the establishment of IPED, that is with the IPED Act, led to an expansion of the mandates, no work study was conducted to determine the capacity needs in terms of organizational structure. Can I just get clarity as to who was supposed to have conducted that work study to determine those capacity needs? Is that still in the realm of the Departments of Public Service and Administration, or is that something that IPED could proactively take on to start setting that framework to inform a prospective funding of the expansion strategy? Secondly, on the reduction of the targets for the number of community events per year, how is IPED mitigating to avoid an aggregate decline in the impacts or the volume of your communications and marketing efforts? So, for example, are you partnering with stakeholders like the DPCI judge, the civilian secretariats, and the provincial secretariats, and even civil societies, so you can piggyback on their events, so that you at least maintain, if not actually amplify, your reach without necessarily incurring costs? My next question relates to slide 33, in relation to the targets for analysis of recommendations to the SEPs, amongst others, but SEPs in particular. Now, earlier on this week, IPED submitted their Section 9N report to Parliament, which showed that 180 SEPs members who were found guilty of very serious charges like murder and rape receive sanctions as light as written and verbal warnings, fines, corrective counseling, which is a completely unacceptable picture, because those are the kind of officers who have no place in the police service and should actually be dismissed immediately. But obviously this speaks to the weak enforcement of accountability in the police service, a recurring theme in this committee's work. So I'm just curious to know what recourse does IPED have to counter or challenge this kind of dilution of your work? I remember from the committee's study visits to the UK, when we met with the Northern Ireland Police Ombudsman, which is IPED's counterpart, an interesting provision that they have in their governing legislation is that the police ombudsman can direct that an independent hearing be conducted where the police are either resisting or contradicting recommendations or findings of that investigative body. So I'm just curious to know, in the current context, what recourse do you have against that? And then with reference to that Northern Ireland Police Ombudsman example, are those kind of measures or, you know, some kind of measures being contemplated in the work that you've been doing in the drafting for the legislative reforms that you've been working on in conjunction with the Secretariat? Also, next question, Chair, second last, is if you could just give us an update on the current state of play since IPED's last appearance before the committee on the 29th of March, vis-a-vis what may be called the Mabula hit squad and attempted interference and intimidation of the IPED. I think that cloud continues to hang over. And then finally, what has been the IPED's perception of the effectiveness of the anti-corruption task team that you're part of? You mentioned that, generally speaking, there's an atmosphere of increased vigor and dynamism in anti-corruption efforts and therefore greater cause for hope. But the ACTT is supposed to be the hub and the anchor and the spearhead, you know, in coordinating all of that. What's your perception overall, possibly since, you know, the last couple of months, and where there are any, of which I'm sure there's more than a handful, your concerns and identify shortcomings and deficiencies with that body. Thank you, Chair.
Much, Honourable Bailey. Honourable Colabona.
Thank you, Chair. I'm concerned about your lack of investigative capacity. I'm sure you're looking everywhere, at every way and means that to try and increase that capacity. But frankly, I don't know how that can happen, considering the shortage of budget. I've always been concerned that you may end up leaning on the SAFs to investigate their own, and then come to you and say, well, this was the outcome of the investigation. I mean, something along those lines, and a massive conflict of interest. And I'm sure you understand that you're deliberately kept short of funds, because you catch crooked cops, and the police have to date and continue to protect crooked cops. The very fact that we have cops found guilty of rapes, etc., and given a little tap on the wrist, is inexplicable, but it happens. So they don't want you to exist. They never have. So Treasury is your last resort, I think. Now, you talk of high-risk investigations. What protection do you have for your investigators? Nothing. Because the death threats come and go. You know, if you're investigating a cop, that's pretty much what they know, is to threaten and bluster. But I fear this committee may talk about this until one of you dies, and then we'll say, well, we really should have gone somewhere and asked for assistance for you. What was the reasoning behind the removal of the performance indicator that measures the number of reports on risk maturity level? And tell us, what is your internal audit program? Is that up to scratch now? Because there were certain issues raised, as you know, like the accruals. What's the situation there? There are issues raised by the Auditor General. And why is there no allocation made for claims against the state as a contingent liability, in that you are so under attack, and being attacked in this manner by the SAPs, basically SAPs members and others? It may prove to have been a short-sighted decision. There have always been, since you were the ICD, there were questions every year on your travel claims, but they, I must say, even 180% growth is quite a leap. I can only imagine it's got to do with the Farm Commission investigations. Chair, I know you asked the question, but I seem to recall last time they were with us, they said they received zero for the Farm Commission investigation. It seems to me that the time has come to go to Treasury, it's a very good argument. You are given specific high risk and complex investigations, and if such as that one, such as the whole Marikana mess, and it's expected to come out of a budget that's supposed to deal with day to day this cop hit that man investigations. And if you said there are high-risk investigations such as these four, ring-fence the money and pay us specifically for those, I think Treasury may want to have a conversation, or be willing to have a conversation with you about them. I think, Chair, I think that's about all I've got. Thank you very much.
Thank you, members. Thank you for those members who keep to the time frames. Honourable Mabija.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to ask this two questions to ask. It is the minor assets register made available to the external audit at share, and the second one is, it just came into my mind that yesterday we had SAPS and DPCI. today we are having IPs and civilians. And what I know is that IPs investigate subs. Now, it just crossed my mind. Who investigates DPCI, IPID, and civilian secretariat? That is just something that crossed my mind. That's why I'm asking, so that I can be clear. Thank you.
Very much, Honourable Mabuja. Thank you very much, members. Let's go to the Executive Director and his team for responses. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Chairperson. If you find it in order, we will handle the responses. I'll give some inputs, and as the specialists want to complement or add on, they will do so at their request. I think the first question, Honourable Chairperson, from yourself about the amounts needed. And I think Honourable Ramatlakhana also touched on it, what's the exact amount needed. And
this is the microphone, Director, otherwise we're not going to hear you, just in front of us.
Okay, and what is the right amount of the structure, the total complement, what should it be, what is the total needs, and especially in the light of the now emerging fact that the corruption and big corruption in SAPS is widespread. It's deep and it's collusion and connivance. I think the first issue is to mention that for many years, at least post-1994, a lot of the corruption has not been detected. It has not been discovered. No one looked at it. The counter-intelligence section of crime intelligence was unable to pick it up. It had to be left to IPID to do, which is a relatively new organization. We're in our sixth year. We haven't reached 6 years yet. We had to discover it. So the will to identify corruption and deal with it is not there in the leadership of SAPS, and that's why it hasn't been done. So what has this got to do with the budget as it's needed and the size? Well, what has got to do with it is that if we have to start cleaning up and going through everything and getting the links and combinations and permutations of corruption, it will take us a long time. It will take us forever with the staff we have. If you gave us 100 more investigators tomorrow, this will take us 10 years to get to the bottom of what's been happening in the last 15 years. So that's the extent of the problem. The 20 million figure is basically a stopgap measure, and it's understandable that when IPED was envisaged by legislators, we were basically the international model. There was nothing else to look at. We were setting the pace. We were the pioneers in this field of independent investigative oversight. The result is that the excellent work in spite of all the excellent work that went into legislation and preparation of legislation, we could not have envisaged every single aspect or eventuality that will arise in the future. Also, the extent of the problem, we were not aware. IPED had been ICD, and then it translated after the IPED Act, which was passed in 2011 to in 2012. And that I'll just go to slide 16, the question also about what must be the capacity of IPED. I think every year at this time we make this point, that in 1997 the Department of Public Service and Administration, after a study, had indicated that ICD, our predecessor, with a more limited mandate, should exist of 535 posts. That should be the complement. Now, since 2012, we have become IPED with the expanded mandate and need for higher specialization, and we're still at only 415 if there is concurrence between the two ministries for the Sector 27 posts. So this issue has been answered and has been brought to the attention of this committee every year. We brought it to the attention of the ministry. Every minister that's coming, we brought it to the attention of Treasury. So it's there. The AG has indicated in the report last year that the lack of funding, the lack of adequate funding for IPED threatens IPED status as a going concern. That should be the biggest red light, should be the biggest warning. We can't say it much more. If we've made the position clear at every instant, at every door, we've knocked it and we've cried at every place. Our wheels have been squeaking. We haven't received the necessary oil. In terms of the Falun budget out of Falun Commission, well, we've received nothing. And that is a simple decision to get it done. The previous minister was sitting exactly where I'm sitting here, and he was asked, is he going to do anything? And there was a deathly silence from him. So we didn't get it. Budgets is decided through a number of processes, and we have complied each time with what we need to do and what we need to raise. So the 20 million is a stopgap measure. It helps us just to reach next year, to limp along without completely failing in our mandate. I just want to deal with some of the honourable members' questions. Firstly, on the figure on training is correct. The figure is wrong. The figure, Mr. Sissoko will talk to what is the correct figure, but MTF period of 75 training annually doesn't add to 325. But Mr. Sissoko will deal with that. So thanks to that issue, we'd like to apologize for that error here. On the issue of what makes a case high profile or high impact, it's a number of issues. Just to give an example of what it is. So we look at the position, the rank, the amount involved in corruption, and what impact does that person continuing to hold that position hold? So a person with a low rank who's at the border in Messina who is corrupt, a cop, has perhaps even a higher negative impact on the country's national interest than a general who is stealing millions of rand together with service providers. Because a border point is a very important strategic point, and contraband can move in and out, can lose revenue if you have corrupt officials at the border. So those, it's a combination of issues, so we have that discussion. Of course, in terms of the IPED Act and in terms of the Constitution, we investigate on receipt of complaint or where we have certain information and the ED can initiate. Now, what we do in some of these cases where ED has a discretion to start an investigation or not, we usually send it to the provinces and let them have a deliberations on it and send it back to the head of investigations. They must decide the chances of successful investigation and prosecution, so that the absolute power of the ED to decide is diminished, and there's a more deliberate, rational process that has gone through. So we have a process in place as part of our SOPs and directives as to ensure that the issue of high-impact cases cannot be abused. For example, why do I take this one, which is 1 billion, and not one that's 5 billion? Why do I take it for this general, but not that colonel? So there's a process that we go through internally. We will also develop and we are in engagement already with other similar organizations to look at case selection criteria. So a more stricter permutation of how you come to the conclusion, yes, it's a go. This becomes especially important with limited resources, because limited resources, you can't do everything. There's also the point from a strategic level that if you cover everything, you investigate everything, you are weak all over because you're spread thin. So you have to look at also making impact, putting your resources in one area where you know the impact will be. So if we view it as an attack. So you look at where it's most vulnerable, most weak, and where the corruption is most rife and it has the most negative impact on morale of the service. So the issue goes to impunity. Some people have been untouchable until we touch them. Then they no longer were untouchable. So you make an impact. Immediately you do that, and then the morale lifts. How do we know it lifts? Because more information comes out of SAPS and tells us what is going on. So we actually know. I think it's worthwhile to make the point that none of the assertions that we've made here in front of the PCP or in the media have been proven to be unfounded. Not one. Not one of the assertions. We now have evidence of it. And that makes us... Well, someone asked a question about the Mabula hit squad. Well, they are very active as before. Mabula himself, very, very active. And the attempt is to defeat the ends of justice, to entice people to commit fraud, and to establish a corrupt relationship with gratification for posts within SAPS. So it's Mabula in combination with some people from crime intelligence who we know and who we have evidence of who they are. So I think that answered quite clearly. On the anti-corruption task team, there's nothing going on there. We don't know when last we've been invited to one. And when we go there, there's a lot of talk, no action, a lot of bluff and bluster. It doesn't serve the purpose for which it was intended. The issue might be lack of will. Maybe in the present environment where there seems to be a determination to deal with corruption, things might improve. At the moment, I think the important people in the anti-corruption unit, maybe we all need to be pulled into a room and wrapped over the knuckles to do our work, just to do our work. That is all that's required. On the disciplinaries that become a sham, that people get, a tap on the wrist, there is some relief to be found in a judgment from South Gauteng High Court in which where there's a disciplinary that has been clearly a sham, you can ask for the disciplinary to be reheld. Unfortunately, we do not have sufficient resources to deal with them. They're so plentiful. It's, to be quite honest, honorable members, police protect each other. They function like a gang. We call it the blue curtain because what goes on behind the blue curtain, it's beyond us. The police function like a gang, and you will see as more and more of these cases emerge and more of it is revealed, you will see the extent to which racketeering is the way things are done. Mm-hmm. That's the way it's done. And that is why I made the statement the last time I was here, that it's the biggest threat to national security is corruption in the police. Very often we're told that foreign agencies are interested in us. If foreign agencies know that our police like to take money from service providers, it's so easy now. Our police sit with the most sensitive information of what's going on. So the threat is there with the police. So if we have police who love money, who love nice things, who are willing to sacrifice principles and the oath of office, then we don't need to look outside anyway. We have to look in our own house. The way of operation is corruption and covering up. And every day we are inundated, besides threats, with approaches direct and indirect, to make us look the other way. Unfortunately, this team that's here has bled too much. We're not looking any other way. We are focused on what we're doing. We suffered for doing the right thing. So there's no way we're going to look away. So to all of those who are approaching us, you can stop now. It's not going to work. Just back off. Honorable members, I will ask the other members, starting from my left and moving towards Mr. Dlamini from Mr. Sissoko, just to add the various parts that I've left out. Thanks.
Thank you, Executive Director, Mr. Sissoko.
Thank you, Chairperson. The Executive Director already indicated in terms of Falam that there was no specific funding given. I think it's important to note that part of the Falam Commission recommendation, for instance, was in relation to us establishing our own forensic and ballistic capabilities, because they viewed the fact that we're still using the police as inimical to our independence. Now, there is no funding in that regard. Now, this issue is also linked to the issue of, I think, Honorable Mbele on the work study on our capacity. We have, on previous occasions, numerous occasions, presented to the committee that we've crafted an expansion strategy. Which expansion strategy is supposed to address the issues of our capacity? And in terms of that expansion strategy is to ensure that we have representation in every district in the country, and we have offices that are district or regional offices, which are not satellite offices, but that are fully capacitated to be able to deal with the work that comes our way. Because currently we have satellite offices, which it has always been an idea that it's a temporary structure which must be capacitated, which never really happened. So In terms of our expansion strategy, that's what we envisage, that in a phase-in period we'll have an increase in the number of district and regional offices established in different provinces. And that expansion strategy was also costed. I can't remember the costing on the top of my head because I don't have the strategy with me, but my recollection is that just the budget for investigation in what was costed was about our current budget, just for investigators. So you will see the extent of that. On the issue of the NCIT team and how the performance is measured, our NCIT team will conduct these high-profile investigations, which are project-driven investigations. So by their nature, these are complex investigations, but we have already seen the results. The former National Commissioner General Pasani has now been charged. This is as a result of these investigations. And if members will remember when I presented on this issue, was that when we started this investigation, it started only as a investigation on a corrupt relationship between General Pathani, Crime Tech, and Criminalistic, which is a service provider. But as a result of this investigation that we are doing, then we picked up just one transaction of 45,000 rand, which linked this Criminalistic service provider and FTA. And when we pursued that line of investigation, voila, we then got the big corruption relating to cheating and FTA. Now, as I'm saying, that because these are projects, so when what happens is that when we pick up this information that comes through, then we do another project to say how do we get to this. So it will be then a continuous thing. And as the chairperson says, these are complex investigations and they need a lot of resources. Just to indicate, Chairperson, recently I had a meeting with General Matakata to request that because they've assisted us with only two members to assist in this investigation. And I approached her to say, given the enormity of what is coming up and the contracts that we're looking at that are within SAPS, she needs to assist us with more people to assist the chief. She has agreed that she will do so. We're still waiting for the people to come through. So that is the kind of things that we're doing, Honorable Mhlongo, to try and get assistance from other departments to assist us in this mammoth task facing us. For instance, as part of this investigation, as I indicated before, we approached National Treasure to say some of these investigations, they need the forensic investigation expertise of auditors. We do not have the budget nor the capacity to do that. So we approached the National Treasury to assist us in this regard, and then they have come to the party and appointed a forensic firm to assist us in evaluating these complex bank statements and contracts and so forth. So that is part of the work that comes also and assistance that comes from other government departments to assist in this regard. On the question, Romaje, why we changed from percentages to numbers? When we did our analysis, we realized that, for instance, when we put a percentage will look just a percentage as a number. Now, like you rightly point out, that we do not know how many cases we'll receive. So if we project that we'll receive 100 cases and we put a percentage of 50%, then it means in terms of numbers, that 50% translates to 50 cases. However, if we have projected 100 cases but we receive 200 cases and we have put a percentage of 50%, that 50% translate to 100 cases in numbers. Now, our capacity as a department and the number of investigators we have does not accord with that. Hence, we found it prudent that let's look at the numbers, because when we have the numbers, then it's something that is static and it looks at the extent to which we can be able to investigate the number of cases based on the number of investigators we have and the budget allocation that we have. So that was the consideration in that regard. And thank you for alerting us to the error that we made, as indicated, that relating to specialized training. It is in fact 225 and not 325, as we indicated, and we apologize for that error.
For just a moment, Honorable Bailey, follow up on the same issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. If I may, just a quick follow up on an information point. Do you have a figure of what the average caseload is for an IPRIT investigator at any given time or in the course of a year? I just want to get a sense of how that is relative to the SEPs, for example, and also because I'm just recalling from my notes that, to go back to the Northern Ireland example, they said to us that their investigators carried 20 to 30 cases each at a time. I just want to get a sense of relative comparisons. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Bailey. Mr. Sissoko, you're welcome.
Thank you, Honourable Bailey. We, as part of our strategic planning process, planning for this current APP, we did those kind of analyses. We tried also to cost our investigation to see, you know, what would be appropriate for us. For instance, on average, we're looking at 60 cases based on the number of cases that we have. On average, 60 cases per investigator, you know. But obviously, that will change in relation to what comes our way. you know. But what we looked at is for us to be able to do our work optimally, you know, what we thought would be a reasonable casework for investigators would be about 60 cases, you know. So, but our reality is that we cannot stick with that number because based on the intake that we have and the backlog that we still have to deal with, it's not possible that that is the only cases that we deal with. I think also what is important to note is that whilst we have cases that are intake cases that we receive, and then we still have also to deal with the backlog, but there is other cases also that are going to court that we have to deal with. So our investigators are not only seized with just looking at investigating those, but they have to sit in court, go to court in matters that go to court, matters that go to a disciplinary. So all these cases, they also have to ensure that they are processed. So our work is not just about receiving and investigating that, but it goes beyond that. And then, so on the issue of the old study, I think I've dealt with that. The issue of the update on Mabula Squad, I think the ED addressed it to an extent, but our reality is that we had hoped that our approaches to the National Commissioner to say we have a concern in this regard will yield some fruit. It has not. Because our view was that even the litigation that we have instituted to stop them from interfering in our investigation was that it could be amicably resolved between the two departments, especially that we are in the same ministry. However, what has happened is that in the litigation itself, the National Commissioner has filed papers that he will abide, whereas those that report to him are still continuing with the opposing the point that we are raising, that they should not interfere with our investigation, and those that we investigate should not counter-investigate us. So that matter is set for hearing in the High Court in June, on the 20th and the 21st of June, I think. But despite the fact that we have a court order that both SAPS and IPED had agreed to, that this team cannot conduct any investigation against us unless there is a direct and written instruction to do so by the National Director of Public Prosecution. They have continued to do so. In fact, what came to us recently is that they in fact approached, as we've indicated in the last appearance, approached some of our investigators that they must falsely implicate the management of IPED as well as some of our investigators involved in this high profile investigation, and with a promise that they'll be given higher positions within the SAPS. Now, this is something that is still continuing, and this goes to the core of what our mandate is, and that as a constitutional institution, we are being hampered in doing our work. And I think, Chairperson, this will also be part of what we'd want to see happening with the amendment, so that we stop this from happening.
Just a follow-up there from Colonel Barnett. I also just want to know, this specific, I think, interference, was that raised with the executive authority? Was it raised with Mr. Kele, and what was his reaction? Honourable Colonel Barnett, Honourable Ramadakani.
Chair, I thought the meeting that we had where we pulled the DPCI and Sean Abrams, basically, into the one room, and had them thrash it out was very successful. And what I'm hearing here is just so awful. I think it's time we sat the SAPs on one side, we sat them on the other side, and we played referee and tried to get to the bottom of this. I mean, I've just read the breaking news that now part of your investigation is General Adelaide Shezi, which shakes me rigid. But every time I start believing in a cop, I find they're being investigated by you guys, and I'm so horrified. But we really, and I can imagine, they've got all the power on the SAP side, and they can actually wipe this lot out with one car crash. It's that easy to do. So I really think it's time we pull them into a room together and let's just get to the bottom of this thing once and for all.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Rabbit Lakhan, you also wanted to come in. Thank you.
No, Chair. It's fairly just shocking to listen to this. The things that we thought we discussed some time back. I mean, we had a meeting with the former Acting National Commissioner Patlane somewhere in the old assembly. We discussed this issue. I think it was pointed out to them quite clearly that if they do that, they will be themselves committing a crime. I mean, if they were to do what they are doing to IPED, which is IPED has got a mandate in terms of the Constitution, they will be defeating the ends of justice themselves. So it's shocking to hear that it continues, even though that there's an agreement between the National Commissioner and the IPED. It's strange that the National Commissioner would agree on something, but on the ground, contrary is what has been implemented. Because the police doesn't operate like that. I mean, the police is a paramilitary structure. Get instructions. So unless you say, in fact, this is what we will have to test, unless what has been written on the paper, an instruction that goes behind it closed or something different, then it's actually a problem to someone who's written a concerted agreement that we're going to do this way. So I think, Chair, I want to concur that perhaps we should have at some point a discussion that brings the police together, and that the IPED would prepare this evidence information for us to be able to work on this issue. Basically, we would have to get a report from IPED around the happenings that is happening now, which forms which could make sure to make that kind of conclusion. Then we need to call the SAPs into to explain that particular issue, what is it that they're doing. And I think it's a matter that will probably has to be escalated even to the Minister of Police, because I don't think something like that can be condoned. I don't even think we can listen to it that is continuing when we had a discussion a year ago on it. Thank you, Chair.
Maybe on the last proposal, and also Honourable Kolobana, we will use that Friday. We must just use the 2 weeks in May for the legislation. We want to finish the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill, and then that Friday after we finish, we will target that meeting. But let's go to Honourable Mr. Sissoko. Thank you. Honourable Bele.
Sorry, Chair. Just a question that just came to mind. So, I mean, given the report we've heard from Mr. Sissoko and the ED about basically the rogue, Mabulekon rogue, is that purely a disciplinary issue, which means that the SAPS management and the National Commissioner, it falls in their courts, obviously with the backing of the minister, or is there potentially then a criminal dimension to that, which would then open the door for, among other bodies, the IPED to investigate? Because clearly, you know, consequence management and accountability enforcement is going to have to crack down quite hard here. Yeah.
There's a number of angles in that matter, but from an oversight perspective, I mean, there must be cooperation from SAP side with IPED, and if there's agreements, we must have that interaction, so we'll have that. Let's go to Mr. Sissoko.
Just one second, Honourable Chairperson. Yeah, to answer before Mr. Sesoko continues. It is criminal. The defeating the ends of justice, offers of gratification, conspiracy to do corruption and fraud is criminal. On the disciplinary side, we've already submitted recommendations on other matters involving torture to the National Commissioner for the suspension of Mabula and his team, some who are on trial now for torture. He's not been suspended yet. Some time ago already was there. But the issue is also there are five prosecutors from NPA which must not be left out of that meeting that has been proposed. It's the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit. On every case where they've attacked people who are fighting against corruption, they've lost every case. But they continue to do it. There is a criminal conspiracy between Mabula and at least two of the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit prosecutors. It's evidence which we have.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. On your question whether we've briefed the minister on this issue, we have, and we expect that the minister will be doing something about it in due course. The issue that Honourable Matlakane raises is that we also find it very strange that the National Commissioner would file papers and say he would abide, and then you have people that report to him, and Mabula in particular still pursuing this matter. We're asking a question of principle and, in our view, a constitutional issue that says when a person is an investigator, cannot be conflicted in that investigation. And that is why, Honourable Chair, even in our Act, it's very clear, it's in our Act to say our investigators, they cannot investigate any matter that they've got a conflict of interest in. How is it then possible that we can expect that police officers that were investigating for serious crimes, they investigate us and they conduct an objective investigation? It can never be. So hence we're raising this issue, but we said, look, there, because the matter is already going to court, there is nothing we can do. We have agreed, and we've always been amenable to have this matter resolved, because we when we started this litigation, it was when General Pahlane was the acting National Commissioner. Clearly, with him, we're not going to win because he's one of those that was opposing. When he was removed, and General Mutiba was appointed, we approached General Mutiba to say, "Here's an issue. Let's try and resolve it amicably." To be fair to General Mutiba, he instructed one of the generals and his legal services to try and settle this matter. We then arranged a meeting between our legal team and their legal team and ourselves. And in that meeting, the team from the SAPS indicated the willingness of General Mutiba to have this issue resolved and concede to what we were requesting, to say these people cannot investigate us and that they must be removed from here. In any event, they are from Northwest. But in the course of that, then a person from the state attorney representing the police then says he wants an adjournment of the meeting, and then they go out, and when they come back now, that is no longer on the table. And then, and these are the people that were initially representing Pahlane when we started with this matter. So clearly the position that was being taken by General Mutiba was no longer on the table. And then it went on like that. For a while we thought, you know, they won't be interfering because there was a lull for a while. And then all of a sudden we then heard that they wanted to charge even further people from our investigators who are dealing with this matter. So When General Sithole was appointed, we did the same thing. You know, we got correspondences that we can show that we tried to say, let's try and resolve this matter amicably, because it's a principle thing. You can't have the police officers who we are investigating and our suspects in our case investigate us. So it has not happened, unfortunately, Chairperson and members. And we're hoping the intervention of the minister will assist, but also maybe the litigation itself will resolve this issue. On the question, Honourable Barnard, of what protection do we have for our investigators? We have indicated that we've received death threats. One of our investigators recently received one also, 2 days ago. We believe it's linked to the same ROC unit, even though it's made to appear that it's from the inside. It's part of what we will be investigating. Our NSIT team, when we were recruiting it, we tried to recruit members with also protection capabilities. But that is clearly not enough given our capacity, because these are the people who assist with investigation, but also when we get into dangerous situations, these are the people that we must also use. For instance, in the KGB matter, when the prison authorities called us to say he was attempting suicide and then to take him to hospital, we also got intel that in fact it may be a ploy for escape. So we had to deploy these members to go and assist the prison authorities in terms of taking him there. So we tried to make with what we have, but it's clearly not enough. With regard to ring-fencing investigation to request specific funding, like in Marikana, Honorable Banan, that's what we actually do. Because when we go to Treasury to request funding, we indicate that for this specific, for instance, Marikana, this is the funding that we request based on the costing that we did in terms of what we need for that specific investigation. And unfortunately, we've not been successful in this regard, but we do that kind of ring fencing. On the question who investigates DPCI, IPED, and the Civilian Secretariat, the Constitution enjoins the South African Police Services to investigate everyone, basically. So IPED is investigated by the police. Most of the cases or cases that are opened against IPED officials are investigated by the police. DPCI falls within the mandate of IPED, so we investigate IPED. Civilian Secretariat for Police, they are civilians, so they'll also be investigated by the police. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Let's get the CFO.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I will deal with the questions that the ED didn't deal with that relates to the budget. I think the first one was to say, why do we budget 67% for compensation of employees? I think this one, honorable members, I think you are aware that the nature of work that we are doing as IPD is that it's a labor-intensive department, which means we rely on the investigators to actually do the work. So the 67% is only to cover the warm bodies that are currently there. It's not even to cover the ideal structure that was approved by the DPSA, which required that 535 people need to be employed. And then the second question was to say what is covered under the transfers. The transfers, it's mainly your transfer to the CTAS, which is for skills development, and also the transfers to household. Household, I mean the people who are about to retire in the department, they are budgeted under the transfers to household. And then the other question that was asked was to say,
accruals, what are we doing to address the accruals, and what is that you are doing to address the qualification in terms of accruals. So there were two issues that the Auditor General raised. Firstly was to say the disclosure on accruals, it was not accurate. So what we've done since then to address the qualification was to say, let us recalculate the accruals for 2016-17, meaning that let's identify all the services or the where goods and services were delivered at year-end but was not disclosed. So we've done that, and we've shared the recalculation with the Auditor General, and so far they were happy with what we've done to correctly disclose the accrual. So we are quite confident that this financial year, this qualification will be addressed. And then the second part was to say, then, what are we doing to deal with the issue of accruals? And again, honorable members, I need to emphasize that the reason why we are having accruals in the first place is mainly because of the underfunding that is there, mainly on our contractual obligation. What I mean by that is that not all our contractual obligations are fully funded. I mean, if you look at the buildings that we are currently occupying, you'll find that there is a shortfall in terms of how much we are supposed to be paying for the buildings and what is actually in the budget. So what it means for the department is that we need to take money from other items to cover the shortfall in terms of those contractual obligations. And as a result, then it leads to the department incurring the accruals. And how we are dealing with that is that we've got a budget control committee which sits on a monthly basis. Its main goal there is to make sure that each and every expenditure that we incur, we scrutinize that expenditure to make sure that it's aligned to what we want to do as IPED, and also to monitor ongoing to say, are we able to reprioritize some of the needs that we have? And then secondly, what we do, we try to identify those areas where there might be some element of wastage, and then we put the correct measures in place to make sure that, you know, we counter that. So that is some of the measures that we've implemented internally. And again, like Edie has already mentioned, is that we'll continuously lobby for additional funding to make sure that we cover the shortfall that is there. I think, again, Chairperson, it goes back to the first question that you raised to say the 20 million. And I can confirm that this current financial year, we need at least 20 million, but to maintain the current activities, which means we can't take any new responsibilities in terms of our mandate. And then the other question was to say, in terms of the budget proposal that we submitted, how much was submitted and how much was actually received? So the total bid for the department in terms of additional funding, it was 172.1 million for the MTEF. So the commitment that we've received, it's around 157, which is the money that we are going to be receiving from SAFS, which means there is still the shortfall of 25.1 million that is there. And then the other question was to say the shift request for by the department, was it approved? So, Chairperson, there were two requests that we made to the National Treasury. Firstly was to say, can we move money from our compensation of employees to cover the shortfall on goods and services? And this one, it was rejected because it was against the Appropriation Act, where you can move money from your COE to your goods and services. And then the second one was to move money between the programs. So this one, it was approved, where we are moving money from Program 1 and Program 3 to cover the shortfall, mainly in your Program 2, which is our core business. So this one, it was approved. And then the other question was to say, all the items that are listed on slide 17, are we saying that we won't be able to continue with these priorities? And the answer is yes, because we've highlighted them to say this is our unfunded mandates, which means we don't have enough money to cover these activities. So it means if we don't get any funding to cover all of these activities, we won't be able to fully implement the activities that are listed there. And then the other question was on our strategic partnership to say, are we considering having any strategic partnership to cover the shortfall in terms of the budget? And the answer to this is that we are currently drafting an internal policy that is going to guide our partnership with other departments. And I need to emphasize that, you know, based on the nature of IPIDS, we can't partner with the departments that is going to compromise our independence as a department. So we need to be very careful in terms of how we engage with other departments in terms of those strategic partnerships. And also the same principle is going to relate to our donor funding. So the policy will address then to say, how should IPIT approach the whole issue of strategic partnership as well as donor funding. So we're hoping to finalize it this current financial year. And then the last question was to say, do we submit the minor asset register to the auditor for auditing? And the answer is yes. So minor asset, it records all the assets that are below 5,000. And currently we've got assets that are worth 2 million that are disclosed in the minor asset register. So we share both the minor asset register as well as the major asset register with the AG for auditing. So they do look at both our asset register. Yeah. I think I've covered all the questions.
Thank you, CFO. Colleagues, at this stage, we're going to take a 10-minute break. 10 minutes. We'll come back then for the other responses, and if there's any other questions for clarification. Of course, remember, we still got also the civilian secretariat. They have been waiting since 8 o'clock eagerly for the opportunity, so we don't want to disappoint them. Thank you.